And there on the cover is a PEB drawing of Anthony Black. And I got the biggest kick out of it. And when I sent it to Tony, he didn't remember ever seeing it. So now you got it forever, Tony. And getting a PEB of yourself. There was also in the same issue the one of Rich Migliori. We talked about it with Rich. But it was titled Record Spree at AC. Tony Black, who tied a 62-year-old record by riding 9 consecutive winners last Thursday and Friday, set a record at Atlantic City when he won with his first 2 mounts Saturday. The double gave the 40-year-old veteran 9 straight winners at the track, breaking the old mark of 7 set by George Velasquez in 1967. And I don't know how PEB did it, but it looks just like you, Tony.
That's why they say I've got a good face for radio. That's what I've been told. Now, you know what, Steve? Honestly, when I saw that article or the front page thing, I knew about the 9 consecutive on Thursday and Friday because I had won 2 races on Thursday at Keystone, I guess it was. And then I went to Atlantic City that night and won 3 races. Didn't ride the next day at Keystone and won 4 the next night at Atlantic City. So that was like 7 straight at Atlantic City, but it tied a 62-year-old record at the time for 9 consecutive wins that a rider, Albert Adams, had set at Marlboro Racetrack, like in 1930-something, 31 or 32. I knew about that record, but nobody ever told me that because I didn't ride that Saturday until Atlantic City, that the 7 consecutive and the 2 winners, the first and second race at Atlantic City, made a record at Atlantic City of 9 consecutive. Or I did ride that Saturday, but I didn't ride... I rode a Keystone that Saturday, and then that night I rode Atlantic City. I didn't realize I set a 9 consecutive record just at Atlantic City. I thought the 9 consecutive was from the Albert Adams record that I tied. And the funny thing about it is, when I tied that record on Thursday and Friday, when I went to the track Saturday morning, Phil Aristone came up to me. He says, Larry Letterman had announced that you had tied this old record of 9 consecutive wins in 2 days at 2 racetracks. It was 9 consecutive. If you want to win the 10th one and break the record, you're on a horse today in my race. I told the stewards that I would let you ride my horse, who will win, a horse named Can of Gold. He said, the horse will win, don't take off the one. Or the steward said you could take off the horse and ride Can of Gold. You're named on the other horse. Just take off of him this morning, and they'll let you ride my horse. I told him my horse would win, and you would break the record of 10. It would be 10 consecutive. Well, I said, I think it was a horse for Lupe Preciado or Walter Reeves. I said, you know what? The record wasn't set being engineered or designed. I'm not going to try to break it designing it like that. I said, it probably isn't the way to do it. Plus, I'm going to be slighting the trainers that I'm on a horse for. Well, of course, I didn't do it, and I probably should have. But Can of Gold won, and I was chasing him down the stretch. And that would have been 10 consecutive. And then the whole thing about that PEB article that you got on the front page, like I said, I didn't realize that the first 2 horses I rode at Atlantic City won that day. That night. And because I had already won on Thursday and Friday, 7 consecutive, that set another record at Atlantic City that wasn't a tie record. It broke Georgie Velasquez's 7 consecutive wins, and I had 9 consecutive wins. I never even knew about that record. Never knew about it. The only reason I knew about the other record was because Larry Letterman told me about it, and then somebody sent me a 1990, whatever year it was, the Guinness World Book of Records, and it put me in as tying Albert Adams' record of 1932 of 9 consecutive. So you tell me more about my career that I lived than I know. You told me one day I won the Cotillion and didn't know I won the Cotillion. And here you came up with this 9 consecutive at Atlantic City. I never heard of that one. Never heard of it till I looked at the article on the front page of this 1992 racing form. You're amazing, Steve. You tell me more about me than I know about me.
Well, did you have, you know, because so many, Richie talked about this, because, in fact, he told the story about being given a framed copy of a PEB of him as a jock. Do you have other PEB?
I never got one. I've seen it before, but I never got one when they came out initially with it, you know, when PEB came and did them. He would come to the track and he'd do a bunch of riders. I never got one. I might have one someplace that I forgot I even had, but at this particular time, I don't remember having one. A PEB caricature.
Well, you know, we'd have to, I wonder, because I've seen, you know, I've seen several. They're usually 5x8, you know, give or take. And this one's really, it's kind of cool. Usually it's a jock, you know, kind of standing. But in this case, it shows you riding is the way he drew it. And it's really, I'll put it up again. I know I put it to Facebook because it got a big reception. I can't remember if I put it up on Twitter, too. Maybe I did. But I'll put it up again today with today's show listing. Because it's great. And whether it's the, I don't know what, between the one of Mig, and I thought that was crazy that there was one of Mig in the same issue. I sent him those pages. There actually was one of Jerry Bailey as well in that particular edition. And it's funny because I don't remember from the PEB era. I always think of his drawings on the cover of, you know, of Big Race Days. And, you know, he also did a series of posters that they gave away at Saratoga, you know, different times. And I didn't remember those as being, you know, so regularly featured in, you know, in the copy in a daily, you know, day to day. That was like a Wednesday or Thursday at that August edition that I sent you.
Right, I'm gonna have that put in some type of preserved type of material, because that's classic. And you know what? It is classic because you never see one where the jock's caricature is on a horse's back, and he even has me low on that horse's back. So gotta give him credit. He knew I was getting low, but I just couldn't believe about the record. I didn't even know I had it at Atlantic City. I had absolutely no idea. And I might have a caricature that I got off of PEB. I'll have to go down to my mother's. She lives five doors down in the house that I grew up in, and she's got more of my stuff than I've got. And I'm going to see if I've got a caricature that PEB did. I bet I do. I just, you know, my memory. I always use the excuse, had a lot of concussions. My memory fails me sometimes, but I have to look for the caricature that he did. But I really will cherish this one that you sent me the other day. It was a pleasant surprise when I opened my mail.
I also, I sent you a photo, I took a picture in the Monmouth listings, and this is something I forgot too, when the form for each of the racetrack pages, and this was, you know, this was not the tabloid size. This was the big broadsheet version of DRF, and the individual jockey and trainer standings had a picture of the leading rider and the leading trainer every day in the listings, and there's a cute little picture of you as well, and you were off the summer of 92, you were crushing up at, and you weren't even, didn't even look like you were riding regularly at Monmouth. You had less starts than a lot of guys.
I saw those standings that you sent me. I can't even tell you what year it was.
92.
Yeah, 92, and I had no idea. I was thinking, well, maybe it was the year Garden State burned down, and we wound up going to Atlantic City and then Monmouth. And I was, the year that Garden State burned down in April, that was the, well, that would have been into the spring meet, went March, April, May, and then it was closed down, whatever it was, February, March, April, May. It burned down, and I was leading rider there, and I was like 12, 15 in front, and the place burned down. So I never got any credit for being leading rider at a track, Garden State racetrack. But when I saw that standings, I couldn't, like I said, I couldn't remember being one of the leading riders at Monmouth Park, and let alone leading rider. So you teach me a lot about my career. I don't know how I lived and forgot so much. But I'm glad I have you as a friend, because you make me think, yeah, my career was a little better than I even gave it credit for. Thanks for all this updated info.
I love it. I love it. Tony, in addition, been watching, and you and I reached out to you, last week when there was some follow-up, not complete follow-up, but is there any light for you to shed on this situation with Richie Vega?
Yeah, I feel so bad about that situation because, I don't know. I've talked to him, and, whatever the evidence that they had confiscated from the tack room, and it's I've got no idea. But what I understand, there was no performance enhancing drugs or drugs of racehorses that were of any significance that affect horses running. And on top of that, it's in a tack room that it's in a barn with three other trainers and help, and people are in and out, and nobody, not even a locked room. But it just seems like they're dragging this thing out to make some kind of a statement, which I guess they want to make a statement that, look how we do monitor what goes on at our racetrack at parks. And I got some examples that I could tell you. The people that are doing the monitor should live up to what the standards that they're trying to impose on people, because I've been involved in a case over the years where the people that were actually in an authoritative position, when it went to court, they lied under oath. So what kind of people are you dealing with that can lie under oath? But anyway, over the years, I can imagine, that trainers have had things like bute or Banamine or Lasix at their disposal. And it's because in the middle of the night, if a horse gets colic and the night watchman calls you and says, listen, this horse is in real bad shape, we can't get a vet out here at 2 o'clock in the morning, a trainer might have the something like Banamine, something to try to help the horse till we can get a vet there in the morning. I don't know if that's what findings were with Richie. From what I understand, there was nothing of any significance. On top of that, when you're on the racetrack, the one thing racetrack doesn't follow when it comes to legal procedure is accepted legal procedure that would be followed outside the racetrack, where evidence is guarded and locked, or where, the shakedown procedures, the raid, whatever you want to call it, is done in an orderly fashion, and it's done with witnesses, neutral witnesses, and it's done in a way that you can understand that it's done legally. Racetrack doesn't always follow legal parliamentary procedure or any procedure that would be on the outside. On the outside, it seems to me, the way this thing was conducted, if this was conducted on the outside, a raid of this nature, it would be, if it did get to court, it would be thrown out. And they're dragging this thing out to where they're, to me, and with what has been said to me by a legal response, a person's legal response, is sometimes, they're trying to prove a point, and in proving that point, they want to try to show the public how much they monitor the sport. And they don't mind making somebody a sacrificial lamb. And in my opinion, which is an unqualified, maybe just an old dumb jockey's opinion, sometimes making somebody a sacrificial lamb, as the way I feel like what they're doing, it serves their purpose, but it doesn't really serve the purpose of monitoring the sport and doing things in a legal way that really would enhance the legitimacy of the sport. I worked for trainers, and I won't even mention his name, but he won over 6,000 races, and I used to watch him come into Delaware Park when he had 9 strings of horses throughout California and throughout the country from East West Coast, and he'd come in there with a bag, and he wasn't a veterinarian, and he was just a qualified, highly qualified, you don't win 6,000 races by accident, and I used to watch him operate, and he'd come in, shoe his own horses. That would be unbelievable, just watching a trainer shoe his own horses. But then he'd come in with his little bag, and he'd say, oh, we're going to tap and jack this one. We're going to do something to this one. And I watched him, tap a horse's knee. And the first time I ever saw this highly qualified trainer to have a horse's knee, and he went in from behind the knee, not the front of the knee, and he explained it to me. The way the bones are constructed, you go in from behind the knee because the needle will not irritate the bone. The bones are flat in the front of the knee and not beveled, and you could actually irritate the bone. And I think, geez, I don't want to mention his name, but I used to watch him operate, and I'm thinking, this was really being a horseman in that day, in that time and day,
right.
You know,
right.
In the 70s, in the 80s, you know, the 70s. You know, and he trained horses since the 50s, probably. And he was unbelievable to watch, you know. I remember riding a horse for him, and the horse tore himself up and behind, and I watched him shoe the horse. And it ran, like, won the board at Delaware Park, and the next time he ran the horse, he said, he never will hit the next time this horse runs. Don't you know they entered the horse at Timonium? Here the horse tears himself up on mile turns, and they're at a 5/8 of a mile racetrack. Well, he won by the length of the stretch, and he never touched. And I thought to myself, geez, Jack, geez, you're amazing. You are one amazing guy. And, you know, I witnessed that stuff. I know the game has changed and the times have changed, and you can't conduct yourself in the same way. And maybe that's why it's a blessing that some of these old trainers of this type and this nature have passed on, and they don't have to be in the game anymore. But it just seems to me that they're making this thing into something for the purpose of trying to sell a point to the public rather than really monitor the sport and monitoring the sport and selling a legitimate idea to the public that you're monitoring it and you're the authority that's making sure the sport is on the level. Sell that idea to the public, but don't manufacture a BS idea, and that's what you're selling to the public, and that's what they're doing. And to me, in my opinion, you know, that's my opinion. And like I said, I'm just a high school educated dumb jock that's been on the racetrack since he was in diapers.
I've met Richie 2-3 times, and without more specifics, and we'll see if we can't get more details. But I mean, every piece of reporting thus far, you know, keeps saying that it includes, quote, illegal substances, but then there's what the commission said the other day as well, that there wasn't, you know, at first it was, when Chuka said a significant amount of contraband, you do wonder, I mean, if now that they've tested everything that they found, I mean, I guess contraband can just be the syringes themselves, right? Whether they could be empty.
Well, you can't have an empty syringe at the racetrack. I have syringes that I use on my little girl, and I always make sure I don't leave one lying in the car, because I have different medications I have to treat her with. They're not injectable, but they're syringes without a needle at the end. But you wouldn't want to have an empty syringe in your car. Well, these syringes, you know, whether they were loaded or empty, from what I understand, if you have a drug, whether it's a legal drug, butbanamine, Lasix, something like that, and it's either not in the vial or it's in the vial, but it's in your possession, I imagine with syringes there, you can't even possess empty syringes, and you definitely couldn't have one loaded with banamine saying, well, you know, if a horse has colic, I want to be able to go out there at 2:00 in the morning and give him a shot of colic. You're not going to get a vet out there. Or if you want to work a horse before the break and you want to make sure he's on Lasix, try to get a vet out there at 5 a.m. to give him a shot so you can work him at 6:30. You're not going to get one out there. You know, so maybe that's what, I've got no idea. I'm just using examples of common sense examples, what maybe some trainers think. I mean, this isn't some performance-enhancing drug, you know. It's almost like, well, you can't get a vet, you know, you can have something of this nature, butbanamine, Lasix, and you can treat them yourself if you can't get a vet to come at that particular time. Yeah, go call a vet at 2 o'clock in the morning and see if he comes to the racetrack because your horse has got severe colic, you know. By 6:30, 7 o'clock, he might be dead.
Fair point.
In fact, a friend of mine just lost a horse. They colic on the farm. Nobody saw it for a while. And by the time they got it to New Bolton Center, they had to put it down.
Yeah.
You know? And that's at a farm where they could have had Banamine or whatever to treat the horse with. sad situation. But a racetrack, you know, there's a lot of people around and see these horses all hours of the day. And, you know, sometimes you need to take a precautionary procedure to save one. And that's about the only thing I can say about this whole situation. It's kind of blown out of proportion, and it's selling a bill of goods to the public.
Now, I thought it was notable how when the story emerged out of the Pennsylvania Commission meeting where this was discussed, where the original sweep of a half a dozen barns occurred, and there was all the, you know, there was all the carrying on that you would expect to, you know, for that kind, the way things were termed, and then, you know, now a month later comes the follow-up that, well, what we found was very, very minor, and it doesn't get a tenth of the, you know, it's not to pull out the old, you know, where do I go? You know, it's one of these things where the headlines on day one are on the front page, and then the actual findings and specifics,
yeah,
they're on page 17 in the agate and buried somewhere.
And then you give somebody a severe penalty, a couple years. You know, so even if we didn't find anything, we can show them we're really monitoring this boy. We'll give the perpetrator 2 years. They'll see that. He got 2 years, whether it's under appeal and whether it gets reversed, who knows. But we'll give them 2 years because then it'll really look like we found something, you know. I just think the whole thing is handled in a way that, like I said, if this wasn't the racetrack and this was a similar situation that occurred off the racetrack by the authorities, it would be thrown out of court.
Well, and this can be filed like so many other things of late. If there's going to be the USATA oversight, let HESA, they can solve every problem like this.
It'll be
comprehensive.
Let's give Linda Rice a year or so to get, because she's getting information that you probably could get from any agent that's on the ball, but. You know what? I understand they want to show that they're monitoring the legitimacy of the sport, but let's not get carried away and make people into sacrificial lambs. It's tough enough to make a living in this day and age with the pandemic and everything else that's going on. I walked under Richie's barn the other day, and there was, I think, four horses left in the barn out of the 30 that he had, and I think they're making him take them out of the barn. You're costing a person his livelihood that really, just to me, from what I understand, has not caused any severe infraction and been in the game since for 30 years license and had no real rulings against him. Pretty clean guy, you know. And it just seems like tracks are doing this. And it's not that they're giving the game a black eye. They're hitting themselves in the head and giving themselves a black eye because they're making people sacrificial lambs that really... It serves maybe the unknowing person maybe buys into it, but people of knowing on the racetrack or people that been around the racetrack are saying, boy, you know what? Really do something. Authorities, you want to do something, catch somebody doing something that's legit, not something that you're manufacturing, not some BS.
And that brings up, in fact, I went to look at RMTC's website, and you know, there's the ruling database. I don't recall. Has Richie had any, you know, any positives over the years? Any incidents, fines or suspensions?
None that I know of offhand. You know, I've never seen any, and I've been around him for several years. I was around him when he was rubbing horses for Bill Worthington Jr. Bill Worthington Sr. at Keystone Racetrack, and they were winning races left and right. But I have no real knowledge of him. Any major infractions, you know, the trainer gets a bad test. Well, we've seen that happen. I don't even know if he's gotten any bad tests. I know one thing, I've ridden a lot of winners for him and got paid for every one. So there wasn't any bad tests on any of the ones that I rode. And he's a real quality horseman, you know. And I just can't understand this, why you want to put somebody out of business that has a clean reputation. I mean, racetracks are... Racetrack security and authorities are possibly going about their business in the wrong manner. You know, they're not doing things that really do ensure the reputation and the credibility and integrity of the sport. They're just doing things that sell well to the public because the unknowing public will buy into it and say, boy, you guys are really doing a great job of monitoring and being the authorities in the sport. That's BS. And this thing, making someone a sacrificial lamb, is even a bigger story of BS. But aren't you glad I'm not blue? Because he didn't use the initials of terms of BS or the F word. His interview was classic.
It's so funny you bring that up because we were somewhere. Where were we? Just fairly recently, and somebody said to me, "Oh my God, I just heard the piece with Blue from last month. And they got such a kick out of him. Well, I'm going to see him soon. I haven't been over yet to the track for any mornings. Maybe this weekend. Then of course everybody." Getting their barn set up and that's always kind of fun, you know, when you it's fun and exciting when you go to the backstretch, not just at Saratoga, any racetrack, you know, that's a seasonal facility, and all the tack and all the fans and all the tack boxes and equipment is all piled up waiting for the truck, and you're all excited, then they unload it and then they start to put it into the stalls and into the, you know, set up the shed row. But at the same time, then in September, at the end of August, when you see those piles, it's really sad.
Yeah.
And you know that it's over.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to try to get up there. I've been up there for a couple of years. I like to take my little boy. He's amazed when he walks around Saratoga with me. And he, you know, all he's seen is Garden State or, you know, tracks in Jersey Monmouth or Philadelphia Parks, I mean, whatever the name it is. But when he went to Saratoga with me and we went to the Hall of Fame and then we went to the racetrack and saw all these people a few years ago, he was like in awe. I said, yeah, this is an example of racing that's premier, world-class racing. And he said, I never saw it like this, Dad. You know, this is unbelievable. I'd like to come up there one more time with him. Just, you know, he's 13 now and just take a trip. It's a 4.5, almost 5-hour drive, but it might be worth it. And if I do, I'll definitely stop and see you, and maybe we'll do something live for that afternoon.
Absolutely. That'd be fun. That'd be great.
I'm going to try to get up there. I've even had some invitations to go up there, and I just think, you know, it would be nice, especially because my little boy would really enjoy it. But it's hard to get loose from the homestead. I've got a lot of responsibilities around here, Steve Beck.
Well, no doubt. You got the mother to look after, and you know, there's no shortage.
I got a 96-year-old mother that we went to the motor vehicles because motor vehicles didn't send out any expiration on registrations, so you couldn't do it online. So you had to go to motor vehicles, and she's 96 because one of the vehicles is in her name, and you wouldn't believe how nice some of the people were when I walked into this motor vehicle, which you needed an appointment to get in. And my 96-year-old mother was there, and the place was packed, no chairs available, and people would get up. In fact, one person even got up, gave my mom the chair, and another person got up and said, you can have my chair also. I said, oh, I'm all right to stand. When I'm standing, I'm almost as tall as other people when they're sitting, so I like standing. So, the lady looked at me like, geez, you know, I said, or is it because I look like I'm her husband and I'm 96 too? She said, no. I said, well, I'm 70. I'll be 70. And she said, no, I just thought you wanted to sit next to your mother. I said, no, I can stand.
Even though when by the way, Tony, I did get to for those that are curious, you can go to and thanks to Eric Hamelbeck, you can go to the TOBA website. And by the way, the Tuesday owner's view, the owner's monthly presentation was Tuesday, and yesterday it was loaded. I'll put the link up to that, and you can watch the whole show. But at ownersview.com, when you go to look at trainers, you can pull up their any rulings. Richie hasn't had a ruling against him in 10 years, and not since 2011, and he's had a couple of methocarbamols going back to the back to 2007-8, he's got one for not having full papers filed, one for scratching a horse, not running a horse. That was at Monmouth or Delaware Park, it looks like. I mean, these are minor. For somebody that runs as many horses as he's run, these are insignificant rulings. And to not have had a single ruling against them in 10 years to put on this kind of a suspension and not even detail what's specific, what is specific about it, that to me seems like it deserves a little more information. So we'll see what comes out of it in the appeal.
Yeah, it really does deserve more information instead of letting people wonder or speculate, oh, look what he did, you know. Like I said, if this was off of the racetrack and it was the authorities doing something similar like this off the racetrack, it would be thrown out of court. Wouldn't get to first base. Wouldn't even get to court. But you know what? That's what you deal with sometimes on the track. And parks, sometimes I wonder what their motives are and their objectives.
Well, this is the commission. This is not so much. I haven't yet gotten the. Yes. Yesterday we had. We've had a couple of different the Baffert Naira legalities that there were a couple of shots in both directions yesterday, and there's obviously going to be a court hearing on that. That's a racetrack specific. This thing was something the commission initiated rather than the racetrack, and so they're the ones that have to answer the question.
I wish they would answer them rather than just leave them out there, for people.
Open-ended, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Let it be, transparent. Let's see what it actually consists of. Not let's you use your imagination. No, I don't want to use my imagination.
No,
I
specifics.
Know the facts.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Tony, we'll be talking to you from Saratoga next Thursday.
Maybe very shortly I can come up to see you and just spend the afternoon with you. And once again, I want to state, you keep up the good work, brother, because you do a great job for racing to promote it in a positive way. And you know what that leads to? It leads to me saying, thanks for the time you give me, and I love you, brother.
Love you, too. Tony Black, everybody, immortalized by the immortal Peb. And I'll put that picture up again today with the listing. Tony Black, everybody. We're going to stay right here and look forward to a visit with Joe Clancy. And with Saratoga comes the Saratoga Special. Yeah, and I'm sure this year people, not only are they excited about being back on track, that's part. The Saratoga Special became such a, an instant part of the Saratoga scene. It really was an inspiration, and I'm gonna ask Joe that question. I didn't have a a real specific agenda for Joe today, and so that could actually be part of today's conversation. Joe Clancy, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm good, and it occurs to me, and I'm sure at some point years ago, with you and/or with Sean, the whole Steeplechase Times conversation came up, but connect the dots on the idea of doing a near daily newspaper that became the Special. Who was sitting around after a couple of beers and said, let's do a daily newspaper at Saratoga?
Yeah, and what were they thinking?
Exactly.
As usual, I think the kernel of the idea came from Sean, because he's the idea guy. But if you go back, probably back far in our lives and anybody else's life in racing, they remember when the Saratogian Pink Sheet used to print right downtown Saratoga, and
yeah,
you could actually get tomorrow's paper tonight. Like you would, if you were in town at 10 or so at night, the paper was rolled. The next day's paper was coming off the press, and we were kids because it would have been up going up there with my dad and some horses to run, and we would. I remember getting the pink sheet the night before, you know, and just being amazed by it. So that's probably the nugget of whether, you know, something like that, where it came from. And then, yeah, years later, we had started Steeplechase Times, which seemed like something we could do. It wasn't, it wasn't that daunting, you know, kind of a thing to start, having not done anything like that. I was working full time for a daily newspaper here in Maryland, and Sean was a steeplechase jockey and had just gotten out of college. And, you know, the Steeplechase Times was just sort of doing what it does. And then, like people do, especially brothers, somebody probably said, what about this? What about Saratoga? Could we do something there? You know, and we would take the Steeplechase Times up there, obviously, at various times. And, you know, I think several why not kind of conversations kept happening. And we dove in that first year, probably against our better judgment, but we dove in. And the first year we did six papers a week. It almost, you know, turned us inside out. Sean's college roommate was between jobs at the moment, Paul Wasserman, and he came up and helped us with everything. And we managed to survive and not lose our minds or too much money. It's sort of been something we've done ever since, and it's obviously changed over the years, but so has Saratoga. So you know, the idea of doing it, I think, was literally like a lot of good ideas, would this work kind of thing. And you know, yeah, here we are 20 years later, and I guess it worked.
It absolutely worked, and it became you know, not just something that was nice to, you know, to have to augment you know, your handicapping, or you know, to have as a pull-out guide, whether it was the, you know, the selections, or you know, the charts. Then you know, I you know, I don't know when the features all kind of started to fall into place, but you know, it started out with probably what, 8 pages, or you know, gotten as big as how many? What's the biggest edition you've put out?
Yeah, those first few, there were some small ones that first year. There was a little printing company in Clifton Park, Staffield Printing, and they printed Penny Savers and Shoppers and those kinds of things.
Sure, sure.
We went and had a conversation with them, and I think they thought we were completely nuts, but this was pre-internet and things, where you had to physically drive a disc to the printer, you know, where they then made negatives and plates and eventually newspapers. And one of us, kind of usually Paul, Sean's roommate, would have to he would drive the last disc down there to Clifton Park and then sleep in his car or somewhere until the papers were finished. They would load him in his car and he'd drive him back to Saratoga.
Wow.
And yeah, there were definitely some 8-page papers. And the front of the paper, that here and there section that people like with the names and the quotes and numbers and other stuff, sort of came about because somebody said, we got all this extra stuff, what are we going to do with it? And we started just dropping things in there. And yeah, it evolved over time. I think the biggest paper we've done since then is 72 pages. You know,
wow.
There were early days, like any newspaper publisher, there were lots of limits to things. Like there were, you know, you couldn't have color, you can only have color on a few pages. Yeah, you used to have to go up by multiple, you definitely have to go up by multiples of 4 pages still, but there was a time where we had a printer over in Gloversville that you had to go up by multiples of 8 pages, which that really kind of made you think before you added 8 pages to the newspaper.
Wow.
And yeah, it's changed a lot over the years. Now it's full color. The Times Union prints it down in Albany, and it's color on every page. And, you know, it's just, it's amazing the difference. The early days of scanning, I remember watching Todd Marks scan negatives on a really complicated negative scanner to get us, you know, one picture for the cover, and it took forever. Well, now the photos are just online. You download them and drop them on the page, you know, so very different.
Gloversville. You had to. Somebody had to schlep to Gloversville to.
By then the internet. We just sent the pages there, and then one of their drivers brought them the papers themselves back to Saratoga. Just the climate of newspapers changed, and the ability to find printers that could do it. Like the little Staffield in Clifton Park sold to a bigger company in Troy, and we were there for a little while, and then they went out of business, and then Gloversville was sort of the Glover. They have a daily newspaper there, so they could do it, and yeah, thankfully we didn't have to. I don't think I ever went to that printing plant. again, the Times Union printing division invested in, a really state-of-the-art newspaper press. Probably it's been a few years ago now, but it made a big difference in what we do. At that point, the size changed a little bit. Like, it used to be a much longer paper, but that's just a product of being able to print, go back to a standard size, color on every page, much more flexibility in terms of the timing of it and the page count. When the paper would get kind of big when we were in Gloversville, if it got too big, they had to print it in two sections. So, like, half the paper had to be done early, and then you'd come back with the rest of it, and then they would put it together. So it's really, that part has really changed and made it easier, but it's also made it, it's made you try to do more with it. So I'm not sure it's easier. As the technology changes, you just sort of, let's try this, So that changed things a lot.
Too funny. I just can remember when all of a sudden it appeared, and it just became, part of every day, and it just made, there's an immediacy, obviously, to having, the next morning. And I think when we were running, when we were just starting out, I remember, it was as much of a thrill. In fact, I don't think I've ever really mentioned this to you or to Sean. When we ran Someone Loves You, which was our first starter at Saratoga with Chuck Simon, and she was our first horse. And for whatever reason, who was the artist that was doing those pen and ink drawings?
Wow. Bill Roberts, who was
Bill Roberts, yes,
yeah, was an artist, obviously, but a college professor up that way somewhere. He would bring in these really cool watercolor sketches and things that we would find a way to sneak into paper when we had an opportunity.
Well, for whatever reason, in fact, this is kind of funny. It might have just been the silks. He did a drawing of Someone Loves You, and I remember just being delighted. I think it was called Artist Sketchbook or something.
Yeah.
And there she was, and I've got like two or three copies that I've kept, and for whatever reason, maybe it's the lime green and the blue. Somebody did a similar topic. Somebody sent me a picture, and then I went to go see it. There was an artist exhibit at that little gallery in Saratoga that's at the corner of Congress Park, right at the corner of Broadway, and that must be Fifth. And somebody had done like a little, I'd say 6x6, these little mounted 6x6 paintings, and somebody did a view of a jockey from behind, and it's our silks. And so I don't know why it was attractive, but they wanted like $400. Somebody said,
of course,
you probably want to buy this. I said, not for $400. I don't. I mean, I can probably, I could maybe almost pull that off myself. This little oil painting. But anyway, being at you know, seeing people at breakfasts around town, at Sarge's and you know, Compton's, and you know, everybody's got one, and it has become such a valuable part of the Saratoga scene.
No, that part never gets old. I think for us, when you see people reading it, and you think of what we went through the first few years. I remember, you know, you had to really, it felt like we were begging people to read it when it was first coming off because nobody knew what it was, you know, and to be on Broadway or to be walking into the track and you see people with it tucked under their arm, you know, and you know, now they picked it up somewhere. And back in the early days, we were literally putting them in people's hands and trying to get people to read the thing. So that part is great, really rewarding, you know, and it does show you that people want. They want to read stuff like that. They want to read about the horses. They want to know more, you know. And it really works in Saratoga. It's the same reason people go to the track, you know, in such big numbers at Saratoga.
I have had this portion of the conversation with Sean, and maybe there's some of the interns that you remember that he doesn't, but talk about the graduates that have come through, because it that part has become a big part of the legacy of what you've created.
Yeah, and I can't say we started out thinking we would do that, you know, but I think it just sort of, again, the special sort of proved its value or proved it to whatever, where people identify with it, and whether they found us by accident or whether someone suggested they call us, it's been a little bit of everything that it turned into a foothold in the industry. And you got to give the industry some credit for that too. I think you know, the specials part of it and our reputation helps, but when they welcome a new person who walks in their barn and might not know everything they need to know, but a trainer or somebody will talk to them, you know, I think that helps a lot. So, Travis Stone, who I'm sure Sean talked about, he's one that just I'll always remember, because he stopped Sean just walking in the backyard at Saratoga between the paddock and the clubhouse or whatever, and sort of said, I want to be a racetrack announcer, you know, and somebody said, I should talk to you. You know, I'm an auctioneer and I'm in college and I live in, you know, I live not that far from here. I always come to Saratoga. And the next summer he was writing for us and doing he was doing an internet radio show in a closet of this house we rented because it was the quiet part of the office. And, we were like, internet radio, what's that, you know? and now funny. He's calling the Kentucky Derby, you know. So I think that's one that will always jump out at me. And you know, the list, you know, more recently Gabby Gaudet, who we sort of knew her family, but again, she had to reach out to us and see if that would work. Jim Mulvihill, who's been through numerous jobs in racing, you know, was sort of in between things and wanted to write about it and spent a couple summers with us. And Pete Fornatel and Frank Scatoni were really early. They knew Sean's roommate Paul and helped us the first year of the special with some handicapping and a little bit of writing and some other stuff. It's funny that two guys who were that connected to racing, they knew a guy that Sean knew who Paul knew nothing about racing other than talking to Sean and Pete and Frank, you know. So it's pretty wild. Katie Bo Williams just got a job with CNN covering all kinds of world news and national news way beyond the Saratoga special, but she spent a couple summers with us. Shayna Tiller now has a job with Margot Farm in Kentucky. Ben Gallant,
oh, nice.
At Mill Ridge. Anise Montplaisir, who we called Fargo because she was from Fargo, you know, is making her way through the industry. It's great to see. I mean, again, I don't think we necessarily wrote up some curriculum to say, here's how you do it. But I think that the mix of everything the special does gives people sort of a foothold in the industry. John Panagos, another one, you know, he kind of was in college and doing some other things and came to us and wrote for a summer. Brian Natto, another one kind of he was sort of in between things and spent a summer or two with us. And he actually came down here to Fair Hill and worked with us another couple of years. And it's a cool list. I know I'm leaving people out, which is a shame, but it's what happens too. And it's a mix. Some people want media jobs or that's their interest, and others are more bloodstock or, you know, racing career type things. And I think, again, special provides an introduction to either, you know. I mean, if somebody wants to be
exactly
on the racing side of things, they're going to meet enough people and, you know, sort of get exposed to it. And we try to do that. If somebody wants an interest one way or the other, we try to steer them that way. We obviously need them to write or whatever other area they're doing for us, but I think if we can help open doors, that's obviously part of it.
Is there any room for anybody else? You all staffed up for the year?
This year is weird because of all the COVID things beforehand. It was hard to make any plans, you know, months ago because we weren't sure what it was going to look like. And then, you know, we spend, you know, before vaccines and things took off, you were going to be in a little office with somebody for a long time. You weren't sure whether you could find a place to live or any other thing. So we're pretty good, and we actually don't really have a younger or college-age type intern doing some stuff other than a couple. There's always room. I mean, if somebody wants to write, especially in today's world, you can write from anywhere. So if it's that side, we can certainly help, and we can, you know, we love doing it, so it is worth doing. So I wouldn't hesitate to, you know, anybody can certainly reach out to us if we try to make it work. It's a little harder this year than it's been just because of all the various questions and a little like our schedule. We had to make a schedule early enough so that we could try to get some advertising business going, and so we could tell the printer what we were going to do. And, you know, that was literally February or March. And
wow,
the world's changed a lot since then.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to have to, that's right, to adjust. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but anyway, as always, we're looking forward to it. They could pump the brakes, and, you know, I'd be a little more organized if the meet didn't start next week, but we'll be okay.
Well, it better, yeah. There's no stopping it now.
No.
Joe Clancy with us, and we're talking about the Saratoga special season, which will start with opening day, right? It'll greet everybody Thursday morning.
Yep. That's the idea. As long as the electricity holds out and every other thing, we survived a few blackouts and floods and other disasters around there. So I'm sure we can get it done.
Well, the most important thing you survived was me taking Sean's keys from the office, That was an incident that I somehow could have maybe negatively impacted. Maybe he had to get one of those discs somewhere, and he calls me up and said, "You got my keys?" And I'm like, "No." Oh, wait a minute. Yes, I do. I love it.
We've always been to various places the office has been, and one of the years the office was in a kind of a creepy, spooky Saratoga old house, and some of the people working for us were upstairs and the office was downstairs, and we came there one day and they had basically blocked off one room and shut the doors and we don't go in that room anymore. And we're like, "What?" Well, a bat came in. I'm like, "Well, you can't just leave the bat in the room the rest of the summer. Like, we have to get out of here." There's been a little bit of everything. There was some power outage, and we ran an extension cord through the yard over the fence and plugged into the neighbor's electricity, which was on a different part of the grid or something like that, to get the paper done. And early internet things where, you know, the cable couldn't hook it up in time, and we had to go do it. I remember we went to Karen Johnson's rental house to transmit the pages because she had internet, but we didn't, you know. So
that's funny. I love it.
Something like that.
Well, looking forward to the season of the special, and looking forward to some face-to-face conversations, and, of course, looking forward to the flat season for the jumpers. And we'll do plenty of previews between Sean and Joe, and And, of course, Bill Gallo. So we're looking to that. And one thing I haven't done, I'm back. This is third day back from vacation, Joe. And before we wrap up, looking forward to a visit, actually, with Anise Montplaisir from Amplify, the how do you define it? Same kind of hot box, incubator, let's say, for player and fan interest. Amplify trying to draw, you know, young people to the sport, and they've got a terrific mentorship initiative that they're launching. And I haven't had a chance to have Anise on, so she's going to join us next. But before we go, Joe, some thoughts about the Iroquois, and we talked to Sean leading into the weekend on the 26th, but coming out of it, you know, snap decision. I watched it live, and you know, it just felt like, you know, the Waters was just waiting and waiting, and you know, new member actually ran a courageous race, but when the real running started, it was all snap decision.
Yeah, for sure. It must be some feeling to be a jockey in that position where you're just like, okay, I've got my fifth gear whenever I need it, or even fourth gear, whatever next gear he had, he could have unleashed it kind of at any time. And it's getting old, but the horse has won 9 in a row. He's done, you know, he just answers every question. You know, I'm not sure he's running up against the best horses, you know, we've produced. You're not going to say that Goodnight Shirt and McDynamo and some others are behind him, but that's not his fault. You know, he just keeps winning, and he's now tied the all-time record for consecutive American steeplechase victories. And you know, he did that to me just the way he's done his other things. You know, okay, whenever you need me to go, I'll go. You know, and to go on and do it there and prove it. And you know, he stepped through every condition and every question Jack Fisher's asked of him. And I think, unfortunately, he's going to get a little break now and not go to Saratoga, which won't do the fans much good. But if you're Jack Fisher, both grade one steeplechases at Saratoga are handicaps, and he's going to carry 160, get close to 170 probably, to get anybody to run against him. And he can wait and come back in the fall where there's, you know, a wait for age race at Far Hills. He probably would show up at Belmont as a prep for that, you know. So I get it. As much as we'd like to see him show up at Saratoga, it's a little tricky, and on trying to figure out what to do. And obviously the goal is to put the horse in the best spot. So,
well, it's tough to argue backing up.
Yeah, I know. Right? I want to see him go there because I love it, you know, the crossover of him with the, obviously, the Phipps breeding, and, you know, I think it's good for jump racing to showcase a horse like that. But I also know if you're the trainer and you have him in the barn and you're trying to manage his campaign, it's probably it is the right decision, you know.
Well, in addition to the Iroquois and, you know, the Jack Fisher juggernaut, I don't know how else to describe it. You did have a number of other options, including that Green Pastures, where Cyril Murphy for Mr. Naylor, that Chief Justice, and that was a fun race that included the horse of Kerry Breon's, that Baltimore Bucko and Master Gunner. The three of them were separated by a length.
Yeah, less. I mean, it was a head and a neck basically for three horses, which you love to see a race going, you know, 2.25 miles with that many variables, and it was a big field, 12 horses, and Chief Justice to me, he was overdue to win in America. He'd run some really good races and just not been able to kind of get his head in front. That's got to do his confidence a world of good. Baltimore Bucko's first race back after being in Ireland for the winter and early spring ran really well and stepped up against a good group. Master Gunner is like a relatively new steeplechaser, you know, compared to those two, a lot less experience, and he ran really well too. And then he was beaten 15 lengths, but Fast Car was fourth there, Bob Lapenta's steeplechaser, and that was his first start of the year, so I would think that would serve him well to maybe get to Saratoga too. So it's always nice to see young horses like that coming on, or just inexperienced horses. They're not that young compared to the flat horses, but, and the Steeplechasing's had a hard, you know, it's had a bit of a hard go based on, I mean, last year there were literally 80 jump races in the whole year. So it's just kind of log jammed everything where, not as many maidens got broken, not as many horses progressed through the ranks. And you're just trying to kind of reboot the whole game, which is hard to do, coming out of what we came through last year.
Well, in addition, Princeville breaks the maiden for Doug Fout and Fear Not, and it's certainly nice to see Princeville break through. And after coming to North America, felt like a horse that just didn't want to pass anybody. But that's a nice addition because he seems very durable, so we'll certainly see him. I imagine, and Brion also got that Kerry's Find to graduate as well with the 7-pound Bug, and it was a very good day that at Percy Warner that Sean will, when I see him next week, will tell me how disappointing I am for not being there.
There's next year it goes back to May. Maybe you can sneak it in there, if any racing fan can get there to Nashville for the Iroquois in the spring, it's a great day of racing. I mean, you don't have to know much about jump racing to enjoy it. It's the best, it's kind of the best spring racing we have, along where Far Hills is the best fall racing we have, and it's a great day out. And if you need an excuse for a road trip, you could do a lot worse than Nashville, that's for sure.
Well, we hope people are going to make Saratoga a road trip this summer, and when they do, if it's your first time or whether you've been coming your whole life or since you became a horse player and fan, Saratoga Special, part of your experience. It's in the firmament. It's part of Saratoga. And Joe, I appreciate it. Wait a minute. I've got one question before we go. Before Anish joins us, this coming from Tom Herman, who you know. Tom is looking for update on Footpad and the new Easy Fix fence.
Footpad is home, which is the good news. Back at Jack Fisher's barn, and I think he's still pretty sore, but it looks like he's going to be okay. He had the fall at Nashville, which had everybody really concerned. I think they're optimistic that everything's going to be okay. Spent a few extra days at the veterinary clinic there, improved every day, and is back home in Maryland. And I'm, resting comfortably, as they say, but you never like to see it happen. And, the horse had a pretty hard fall. He's obviously got a great reputation, internationally known, and they want to take care of him for sure. And
nice.
The new fence, I think they're tweaking and perfecting a couple things. You won't see it this summer, but perhaps this fall. And, I think the idea is to get it right. That's the most important thing. So they want to get it right. When it's perfected, it will be, it's got a chance to be a game changer and be able to take the sport other places. It's just modern technology and an easier fence to move and transport to other places and set up and all. It takes some of that hard work out of the equation for steeplechasing, where you can take the fence to other places, whether it's a racetrack or a new meet that wants to get started, that kind of thing.
Joe, I appreciate it, and I will see you in coming days.
All right, won't take long now.
I love it. Joe Clancy, everybody. Follow Joe on Twitter. Follow Saratoga Special and Saratoga TL, Tom Law. We'll haven't talked to Tom in a few weeks. We'll see him next week. And, of course, we talked to Sean right before we went on break. By Sean Clancy and the trio that bring you the Saratoga Special. Speaking of special, I've got there's been a very special effort that has gone into creating Amplify Horse Racing, amplifyhorseracing.org. Anise Montplaisir joins us. And Anise, I first and foremost, I'm sorry it took so long for me to reach out to you.
Oh, Steve, well, thank you so much for having me on. No worries at all. I know that it's a crazy time of year for everyone, so I just appreciate you taking the time and letting me share more about Amplify.
Tell us, first and foremost, before we talk about the mentorship concept, talk about the way the whole idea came about, and you know, the execution is being done really professionally and with real polish. Talk about the origins.
Well, Amplify Horse Racing is now a 501c3 nonprofit, and I co-founded it with Madison Scott, who works for Solis Lit Bloodstock, in 2019. And we were both very fortunate to be part of the Godolphin Flying Start program, but we both came from very similar backgrounds in how we came to horse racing. I'm originally from North Dakota. She's originally from Texas. And as we talked about our stories and as we kind of crossed paths on both of our journeys into the thoroughbred industry, we found that, you know, there's not really a step one for youth and young adults to get into the thoroughbred industry. It's really like you meet someone, you ask questions, you email people, you try to research programs, but there has never really been a step one platform like, okay, here, we're going to teach you how to get into the industry and how to start making those contacts and what all the programs are. So it's called Amplify Horse Racing because we're really here to amplify existing initiatives and really leverage the passion and professionalism of existing industry experts.
And your, you know, your background, in addition, you know, to merging toward, you know, toward the sport, you know, you actually management communication, you know, your background, right? That was your, you went to North Dakota State.
Yes, correct. So I discovered the thoroughbred industry probably around 2008. You know, I loved horses. I knew that I wanted to pursue a career with something in the industry, but my parents' rule was that I was not allowed to study anything equine related. They wanted me to study things that could be applied to a career in the equine industry, but they were very adamant that I always have a backup plan. But I do love communications. I love outreach, education. And so I chose to go to North Dakota State and study management communication, international studies, and Spanish, which has really set me up well for what I'm currently doing. I'm very grateful for having taken on that path, and I'm still taking advantage of a lot of internships, thoroughbred industry, and hands-on internships with horses along the way.
And when it comes to your determination to get to the game, and it, and I understand your parents taking, you know, that direction. Very smart, actually, to you know, have you be sure to have a, not a fallback, but, you know, have a rounded, a well-rounded education. But, you know, we just got off the phone with Joe Clancy. One of your internships was at the special.
Yep.
You worked for the Minnesota, you know, QHRA, at Canterbury as well. And then later when you got out of school and started to work, more seriously toward a career, Fasig and Keeneland and at Mill Ridge, and then you got into the Flying Start program.
Yeah, I think, you know, I heard you talking about the Clancys right as I came on, and Sean and Joe Clancy and Tom Law were just incredible mentors to me along the way, and that's kind of where the mentorship component comes in. And this is kind of the story for a lot of young people who get into the industry, is that you make a connection and you work really hard for someone who has a lot of faith in you, and they will vouch for you along the way and connect you with other opportunities. So one of my very first mentors was the former general manager of the North Dakota Horse Park, a track in Fargo where I got started at. His name is Mike Schmidt. And then along the way, the Clancys and Tom Law really became my mentors, and it was having that connection and having worked for the Saratoga Special that I eventually moved to Kentucky and was able to have the connections to pursue those other internship opportunities. So I'm just incredibly grateful for them having faith in a young lady from North Dakota who didn't know a ton about racing at the time, but had a great passion and wanted to learn.
Well, and it's notable that, you know, you typically when we think about, you know, the proverbial crazy horse girl, it comes from the show side and you know the arena, but you had designs on the racing side right from the get go, right? I mean, you didn't come in off of the, you know, the different angle.
Right, exactly. I saw the movie Ruffian. That was the first racing movie that ever resonated with me. I had seen Seabiscuit, I had seen Dreamer, I had seen, you know, some of the more, you know, slightly warm, fuzzy movies about horse racing, but it wasn't until I saw the movie Ruffian, I think it was in 2008, that I really connected with the sport and started to really, you know, I had a great love for the stories and the people who love and care for the horses and, you know, the horses themselves. And I, for whatever reason, I really connected with her story and the passion and the ups and downs of it. But, you know, racing was always what I wanted to pursue. And funny enough, when I first started volunteering at the North Dakota Horse Park, I think it was one of the first or second years that it was then called the Darley Flying Start Program, but now Godolphin Flying Start. Somebody had told me about it, and from the age of around 13, I just became obsessed with that becoming my goal and wanting to pursue that program. So that was kind of a guiding light for me in seeking out internships and having that, you know, light at the end of the tunnel to want to move away from Fargo and get more into the, you know, mainstream industry.
Well, when it comes to how this has all, you know, been distilled into this initiative with Amplify and the whole idea about bringing the message and you know, the clarion bell of the sport to a younger audience. You know, talk about that mission and that objective and, you know, what you think your approaches, you know, the various initiatives and concepts, how it is working and, you know, what has worked so far in the, you know, the year and a half, 2 years that, you know, that you've been, you know, you and Madison and everybody that's come into play, how you've, you know, massaged it essentially and, you know, tried to, you know, try different things to draw people into the sport.
You know, first and foremost, our goal was to not reinvent the wheel because there's already a lot of positivity out there. There are amazing initiatives, incredible programs, but we wanted to have a platform that helps to promote or amplify those programs and fill in the gaps and, you know, work with and collaborate with others to create new opportunities. And, you know, looking at the broader equine industry, most other horse breeds, you know, whether it's the American Quarter Horse Association or the Arabian Horse Association or the American Paint Horse Association, they all have a youth membership platform, which really serves as a stepping stone for youth to make a connection with that particular breed and get involved. We're not to the point yet where we have a membership component. That's something we might consider in the future. But, you know, when we got started in 2019, it was really, we did a bunch of pilot projects. It was kind of like throwing spaghetti at a wall to see what stuck, what worked. And a lot of that was creating educational tours in collaboration with other organizations. Well, when 2020 came around, you know, we had grand plans to keep doing more of that because it was very successful. It was a great touch point for people who'd maybe never had the opportunity or didn't really know, you know, what all went into experiencing a day at the racetrack to be able to sign up for a free educational tour and have someone kind of guiding them throughout the day. So in 2020, I would say that, you know, with so many people becoming accustomed to being virtual, it kind of opened our eyes to how much more accessible that can make the thoroughbred industry. So that's where we started the website, started all the social media platforms. I host a monthly, what I call, horse racing hangout. I wanted to give people, the opportunity to meet and converse with industry professionals and give those professionals a platform to talk about their careers and the education it took to get there. So every month we have a slightly different theme and either a panel of professionals or one person on to talk about their career. And then earlier this year we started the Amplify Horse Racing podcast, which is, again, meant to be just a basic, you know, beginner's guide to the thoroughbred industry, whether it's, you know, the sales, the annual racing schedule, some of these big events, talking about industry jargon that we would kind of use and throw around without a second thought. Well, we try to get into explaining those things and making it as easy and understandable as possible for new people. And all of the virtual stuff that we've done has had a great, great reception.
The mentorship, in fact, the mentorship is just kicking off, and talk about this and how, you know, because it's a pilot program, essentially, is how you're terming it. You've obviously had enough experience yourself in when it comes to, you know, mentoring from the various intern positions. What are you hoping for, and what kind of response did you get when the call went out for mentors to sign on?
It was, I think, when the whole idea of starting a mentorship program came into our minds, we thought, oh, this is going to be really easy. We're just going to connect people over email and kind of send them on their way. And then I started doing a lot more research into, you know, best practices of mentoring and the different components that you have to have involved. And you really have to have policies and procedures. You have to have a training component for your mentors. You have to have an introduction for your mentees, you know, a formal application process. So there was a lot of behind the scenes work that went into, you know, creating a program that followed best practices as closely as possible, setting it up for success so that we can keep building on it in the future. And every single person I spoke to and asked about becoming a mentor was just so, so excited to be involved and to share their knowledge and share their time. And the format that we have set up, you know, it is a very busy industry. It can be hard to, if you're already working 6 days a week, it can be difficult for mentors to dedicate, you know, hours and hours per month to a program like this. So I formatted it as it's going to be a 3-month program. Mentors will meet with 18 to around 22-year-olds is the age range that we opened it up to for mentees, at least for this initial pilot. And they'll meet for 1 hour per month for 3 months, so starting in August, then September and October. And then at the very end, we'll have a virtual assembly where we'll bring all the mentors and mentees onto talk and have kind of a final discussion to answer final questions about being involved in the industry and their next steps. So we've provided a structure so that every month they have conversation topics to follow, and the mentors can help to guide their mentees in developing sort of an education and career plan. And then the hope is that within those 3 months, you know, they've been given the space to develop a relationship that they can continue on in the future, you know, without Amplify having to be the guide along the way. Because, you know, that's kind of the goal. You're networking, making connections, and then hope you'll have that as a forever connection. So we had mentee applicants from 12 different states. It was just an overwhelmingly positive response. I'm so sad to turn away anyone, but in the future we'd like to do 3 mentorship rotations per year.
I was going to ask as a follow. I mean, how many people reached out and were intrigued enough to ask to be a mentee and not a mento. And then how many people do you have lined up? I mean, could you expand this yet? And if people listening want to act as a mentor, is there still room to, you know, to do some more connections?
Absolutely. So first off, we're accepting mentors year round at any time. They can go to amplifyhorseracing.org/mentorship. And there's a mentor application. And we do ask them to provide some information, provide a couple of references, because we do want to make sure if you're going to be a mentor, you know, that you have some people who can vouch on your behalf and say this person would be an excellent mentor. We want to provide the most positive experience possible. And then all mentors do have to do a background check. In terms of mentees, you know, unfortunately, because we've created such a small age range, which was more for my sanity, you know, I didn't want to have 100 applicants for this first intake. As amazing as that would be, that's a lot for one person to manage. So we had 21 people who applied for this first intake. Unfortunately, we're only taking 10 because that is what's manageable for me to be able to interview, you know, in the future. I think that 10 is actually a great number, especially if we're doing multiple rotations per year. And we do want to maintain the quality of it. Mentees do have to go through an interview process. They have to provide a resume. They have to provide references. So it's something that we want to make sure that these are people who aren't just, you know, oh, that's, you know, interesting. I might dabble in this. We do want to hold up, you know, a standard of they have to be dedicated to it and have to truly be interested to want to be involved. So I'm starting the interviews today, which I'm really excited for. We have some excellent, excellent candidates and a lot of enthusiasm. And, you know, in the future, we might look at expanding that age range because there were a lot more people who reached out and said, hey, I'm in my late 20s, early 30s. I'm looking for a career change. I'm really passionate about this. And, you know, going forward, I certainly don't want to exclude anyone. But, again, just had to... This is a pilot. It's all a learning experience for this first go.
Well, the concept has plenty of proven success, not just from, you know, the various programs you yourself and Madison exited, but we think back to Kids to the Cup, you know, the John DeSantis, you know, Johnny did that for Trudy McCaffrey, her, you know, her influence and her, you know, financing of it, and the, I mean, just amazing success that it had, and the longevity of those that were involved. I mean, this is a great way to, you know, to bring people and get their feet wet and then really immerse them. And you've got so many other initiatives too, Anise, and we'll at Saratoga this summer, we'll get you, in front of the microphone too, and maybe get you on the TV show, because you've got tours, backstretch tours, and interactivity that you've got lined up. There's so many, you know, so many smart and I think just, you know, irresistible ideas that you guys are executing, and you're to be commended. And everybody that, you know, has gotten behind this, including the, you know, in KEEP, the Kentucky Equine Education Project, I really applaud the effort.
Well, thank you so much, Steve. You know, anybody who has any other questions for me or who'd like to share ideas or insight can contact me at info@amplifyhorseracing.org. And I look forward to seeing you in Saratoga and hopefully seeing a lot more people in person.
Without a doubt. And, in addition to following Amplify Racing on Twitter, what's your, I know I follow you, but I'm going to forget, you've got a different, Anise from Fargo.
Yeah, Anise from Fargo. The last name was too long, so I had to find a way to shorten it.
Well, it, not for me. My assistant, my business in Montreal was a Montplaisir. So,
there you go.
I really appreciate this, and this was too long in coming, but we want to really help anything we can with Amplify. AmplifyHorseRacing.org. Anise, we'll see you at Saratoga.
Thank you, Steve. See you in Saratoga, and have a great rest of your week.
I appreciate it. Anise Montplaisir, Anise from Fargo. I wasn't going to ask her about Carson Wentz. The morning flew by again. Dick Powell, of course, and Tony and Joe Clancy and Anise. Amplify Horse Racing, trying to bring more people, young people, in to the game. Good work. Good effort. Good luck today if you're playing, and plenty of options out there. And we will weekend preview for tomorrow, the last weekend before the summer seasons get underway. If you missed anything, and I know some of you listening on the Sirius side, there's baseball that jumped in this morning, but you can catch the replay tomorrow, 6 to 9, or at the website, stevebick.com, archive podcast, etc. Talk to you in the morning, everybody. Good luck.
It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-9 938-4643.